tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirt Bag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirt Bag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland. Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Wish I was mold in the ground. Wish I was mold in the ground. If I was mold in the ground, I'd root this mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
We live in a boomtown metropolis, a place where success is a weapon of war. Some people live in spectacular mansions. Some people can't afford to live anywhere anymore. But Bezos has the money. He's got all of that money. More than $100 billion.
Good morning. That was Eric Bibb singing Mole in the Ground and Jim Page's diss track Amazon. This is Desiree Helligers, and I'll be your host this morning on KBOO Portland for today's Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, anti-colonial point of view. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Coming up on today's show, Lori Mercier interviews Paul Ortiz, professor of labor history at Cornell University and author of An African-American and Latinx History of the U.S. They talk about Latinx activism since the Trump election and how anti-ICE protests and immigrant and labor rights demonstrations reflect a longer history of Latinx organizing and internationalism. And then we bring you audio from a 2017 interview with climate justice activist and labor organizer Tim Norgren. Norgren talks about walking off an LNG job site to join protesters outside and how he came to climate justice organizing through Occupy Wall Street. The interview is part of the Thin Green Line is People's History Project, an open source archive that houses thousands of documents, including public testimony, environmental impact statements, news reports, policy analysis, and oral history. And without further ado, here is Lori Mercier speaking with Professor Paul Ortiz.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Paul Ortiz, who is Professor of Labor History and Latino Studies at Cornell University. He's the author of many publications, including the popular and highly regarded book, An African American and Latinx History of the United States, which was recently banned by Trump's Department of Defense, and we'll talk about this a little later in the show. Paul Ortiz was a historical consultant and featured narrator for John Leguizamo's American Historia, the Untold History of Latinos docuseries that aired on PBS during Hispanic Heritage Month in 2024. Paul is also a consultant and narrator for Henry Louis Gates Jr.'s The Black Church, This Is Our Story, This Is Our Song, which premiered on PBS in 2021. He's currently writing a social movement history of the United States for Beacon Press. Welcome to KBOO, Professor Ortiz.
Well, it's an honor to be here, Lori, to be reconnected with you and to just be a small part of the incredible work that you do week in and week out. So thank you for the work you do, and thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you. Paul, you've written an important article in the recent Labor Studies Journal that argues that the media claims of a growing conservative movement among Latinos, as witnessed by electoral support for Trump, are overblown, that Latino Trump supporters were in the minority, and there were numerous expressions of Latinx working class protests before and after the 2024 presidential election. What were some examples of these protests that were long before the Trump administration accelerated ICE raids, mass detentions, and deportations?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, Lori. And you had shared with me a piece that one of my mentors and guides, Juan Gonzalez, wrote after the 2020 election. And that piece could have been written after every major presidential election in my adult lifetime, Lori. A subplot has been this incredible upsurge of Latino support for the Republicans. And years ago, even I remember in the election of 2008, there were a number of pieces that ran ahead of that presidential election that said, you know, Latinos will never vote for a Black man. They will never vote for Barack Obama. And they will vote, they will instead cross the aisle to vote for whoever is running against him, you know, whether it was McCain. So this is a long and kind of tired out corporate media trope.
So even with the Bush election too, prior to Obama, there was the same kind
right.
of claim,
exactly.
same kind of claim yeah. about Latino support.
Right. And I apologize because I did the history thing and I started going back in time. And you asked me a very pointed question about, you know, Latino or Latinx protests against Trump, against the Republicans. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the reason I wrote that piece in the Labor Studies Journal was because you started seeing direct action, you know, Latinx worker struggles, including hunger strikes, including like stay at home campaigns, including boycotts against these mass deportation policies. A thing I thought that it was important to comment on in the piece was how these became cross-class really quickly. Here's an interesting thing, Lori, that a lot of people don't think about. When they talk about Latino support for whatever Republican is running that year, they forget that over 10 million Latinos probably who could have voted are undocumented. Essentially, they cannot vote. They're working class people overwhelmingly. If they could vote, we'd be looking at very different statistics. It was still true that a great majority of Latinos supported Vice President Harris. But if you could have added in the actual, you know, the core of the working class, Latinos who are farm workers, construction, service, restaurant, et cetera, it probably, instead of about 65% for Harris, it probably would have been about 85 or 90% for Harris. Because in many cases, Lori, around the presidential election of 2024, and then in the weeks after that, it's undocumented workers who are really leading the way in protesting, getting out in the streets, rallying, speaking truth to power. It's incredible to me how many of those Latinos were undocumented and engage in protests in cities like I talk about in the article, Denver, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Minneapolis. Interestingly enough, I had a couple of research assistants working with me. One, my TikTok specialist, Lori, because I don't do TikTok. And unless you do TikTok or new media, you can't really chart where, especially younger or working class people, where they're at, because they overwhelmingly use TikTok, especially, you know, Spanish speaking, indigenous speaking Latinos or people from Latin America, they are on TikTok. And so the research assistants at Cornell that work with me on the piece, one an undergraduate and one a graduate student, commented over and over again, Lori, about how, wow, if you get on social media on that level, you see that the immense resistance against the Trump regime. And this was long before the big mass deportations started. So that's really why I wrote that piece, Lori, was to show, you know, this is where Latinx workers really are. Are some of us conservative? Yes, that's true. We're a very diverse group of people. University professor, right? But I grew up in a shipyard town. My father worked in a federal shipyard for 35 years. The thing I argue that draws Latinos together, because I teach an African-American and Latino history course just about every year, what draws us together is we're either in the working class or our families are overwhelmingly working class people. That makes us a threat. And I think to exist in capitalism, because we bring incredible political ideologies to the table. You know, whether it was women anarchists coming from Mexico in the 1910s or Mexican socialists coming to the United States after World War II, people who were involved in the Workers' Party in Brazil moving to Florida in the 1990s, and we represent in the same way that the Haymarket activists in the 1880s represented a danger to actually existing capitalism. Because remember, those Haymarket martyrs with the exception of one, were all first generation immigrants who spoke primarily languages other than English.
Well, you know, you raise many important points, including just the working class strength of these Latinx movements, social movements throughout U.S. history. And I think what many people don't realize is that part of the strength of those movements is not only just the struggle for labor rights, but also this recognition of the hard labor, the critical labor that Latinx workers provide and have provided historically, and also that they insist and want to bring attention to this being their home. And the fact that so many are so-called undocumented, you know, has a lot to do with the impediments to gaining citizenship and having any real paths for citizenship.
Exactly. And Lori, that's why, you know, Latinx scholars have created a term. Well, we didn't create the term. It was a popular term. And we kind of have brought it into academic discourse, which is Juan Crow. Most of your listeners are probably familiar with the concept of Jim Crow, you know, a system of one party rule, of anti-Black lynching, of disenfranchisement of African-Americans. And so what Latinx scholars have done with the concept of Juan Crow is to really kind of echo what you're saying now. There, capitalism is always, in this country, is always dependent upon millions of either undocumented or disenfranchised laborers. And we understand that the system as it exists here cannot operate. I mean, if it could operate, it would just simply say, hey, let's give amnesty to all of those undocumented workers. But employers and the state love having a terrorized, disenfranchised working class as much in 2025 as they did in 1925 in states like Florida or Georgia. It's just that now with Juan Crow, it's a nationalized system. Imagine if you're an employer. You know, you may be of two minds. On one side, you may think, you know, it would be a lot easier on my pocketbook in terms of paperwork of all these workers and amnesty and just became citizens. Because the U.S. has granted amnesty numerous times in U.S. history, sometimes even without a law being passed. I did it with the Bracero program in the early 1960s. On the other hand, if you're a big employer of the state, you're thinking, you know, it's really to my advantage to have these workers living in a state of abject terror. That means they're dependent upon me. It means they won't organize, that they're less likely to go on strike, they're less likely to complain about whatever working conditions and living conditions they have to exist under. And so Juan Crow is just as, to me, as a scholar of African-American history and Latino history, Juan Crow today is just as corrupt and inhumane and despicable as Jim Crow was back in the day. And the very similar types of things, mass incarceration, you know, the convict lease in the early 20th century, alligator Alcatraz, immigrant detention now, they're not perfect, you know, corollaries or examples. Nothing is, but they have a family, a striking family resemblance.
Well, and this long history of deportations, I mean, especially beginning in the 1930s with the so-called repatriation and forcible removal of so many Mexican Americans from the Southwest who were U.S. citizens, actually born in the United States.
Yes. And, Dana Frank has just written an amazing book, What Can We Learn from the Great Depression? It's a book I think everyone who's trying to figure out how we're going to get out of this crisis we're in now needs to read. And Vicky Ruiz has written about this, Pat Zavea, Deborah Weber, and interestingly, mainly women labor history scholars have written about so-called Mexican repatriation. You're right. In a similar way to now, the Hoover administration, instead of getting down and dealing with the Great Depression and the economic mess they had caused and their allies had caused, they blamed us. They blamed Mexicans. And so they started deporting both citizens and non-citizens, Mexican Americans, make on those. And you see the same thing happening now. I mean, the thing that a lot of people ask me about mass deportations now, and of course, the U.S. did it again with Operation Wetback in the 1950s. This is a perennial theme, Lori, as you've nailed in U.S. history. On the one hand, U.S. capitalism needs the labor of undocumented immigrants, and not just from Latin America, from East Africa, from Eastern Europe, from Ireland, from Canada, other places. And it needs that labor, but it doesn't want to accord that labor any kind of political rights. It wants to use the labor to pick that crop. And then at the end of that growing season, or the end of that tourist season, or the end of that whatever season, get them out of here and don't make them pay taxes, but don't allow them to enjoy the fruits of their labor. It's a very repetitive theme. The thing I say now to people is, what's different now about the Trump regime, obviously, is they're ramping up mass deportations. They're federalizing National Guard. They're talking about, they've deployed U.S. troops within the U.S. So we're reaching a new point of danger. I would argue we're already in the fascist point. But we have to understand that mass deportations of immigrant workers was happening under Biden. It was happening under President Obama. It was happening under Bush. And as you mentioned, it goes back to the 1930s, even earlier, the Bisbee deportation in 1917. The mechanism that the U.S. federal government used to crush the industrial workers of the world, the radical IWW, was mass deportation, the same thing that they're doing now to crush immigrant workers organizing. And part of the reason I wrote that piece, Lori, was to explain to people that immigrant workers are not just victims. They are being victimized, but they have political ideologies, they have beliefs, they have philosophies that hold their communities together, that connect them to the labor movement. It's not an accident that many undocumented people are union members, a very high percentage, in fact, a shockingly high percentage. Because, when I was a union president, if you wanted to join my union, I would sign you up without any questions asked. You didn't have to show me your driver's license. You didn't have to prove to me you're a citizen. That's part of the legacy of the labor movement.
Sombra que empieza lejos aquí. Que poco me da, pero aquí me lleva. Y me pregunto cómo llegué a esta circunstancia.
That was the LA-based band Wake, doing Jornaleros. And now we return to Lori Mercier speaking with labor historian Paul Ortiz.
You mentioned a couple of things I wanted to follow up with, including just this racial profiling. Racial and political profiling. Racial profiling with Jim Crow and Jim Crow, in that clearly the Trump administration is targeting Black and brown immigrants. I mean, we don't see those Irish or Ukrainian immigrants that are being slammed to the ground and treated so horribly, as we're seeing Black and brown immigrants, but also the political profiling. Union people who are active in unions have been targeted, as well as those who have been protesting the genocide in Palestine. And that reminded me of a point that you raise in your labor studies article, that the Latinx movements, protest movements across the country, both before and after Trump's election, have really modeled this kind of internationalism that I think other social movements in this country could learn from. Do you want to talk a bit about that kind of labor internationalism and sympathy for Palestinian rights that we see in a lot of these Latinx protests?
Yeah, I think it's a critical point, Laurie. So, there's a little phrase in labor movement, injury to one is injury to all. And solidarity, we either live that or we don't live that. And American nationalism, I'll say white nationalism, prevents us from living an injury to one is an injury to all, because what that's saying is, oh, it's only injury to one. It's only injury if the person is like me. If they're not like me, I could care less. That is the philosophy Donald Trump wants us to abide by, right? Now, anytime you poll Latinos about the situation in Gaza, starting in about November of 2 years ago now, about 85% of them wanted an immediate ceasefire. That is, every time Latinos were polled, even higher than the majority of Americans who have wanted an immediate ceasefire in Gaza since 2023, right? And that is something that Latinos brought up quite honestly, very commonly. This was a warning sign to the Democratic Party of this country, because often Latinos would say, look, I don't know what is going on in Gaza, but those people are refugees like me, and I had to leave my home country because of economic or political crises or political violence or what have you. And so it's that identification with the struggles of Palestinian people that Latinx voters told pollsters and told the Democrats over and over again, we're watching you on this. We want an immediate ceasefire. What are you going to do? And of course, we know what the Democrats did. They did absolutely zero. You saw it, Laurie, also during the debate, presidential debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, when Donald Trump again uses anti-immigrant racism and hatred, talking about how he said Haitian immigrant workers were eating pets, right? And Kamala Harris, I wish she would have hit back on that much harder than she really did and drilled down into the grotesque racism. This kind of gets back to your point, though, about international solidarity. Because when immigrants are marching in these big marches in Denver and LA, back in December, January, and February of this year, they're not saying we're only in it for us. They're saying we're in it for all workers, right? And I can guarantee you that at the point in which Ukrainian and other types of immigrant workers are abused also, you're going to see Latinx workers standing up. And we have seen that. We've seen, some of the people being targeted in California, or even when the president of SEIU was arrested, people in the labor movement got up and protested. And people in the building trades unions, white, comrades got up and protested. Unions are not perfect, but they remain the best single vehicle we still have for waging a resistance. And this is another thing, Laurie, that the Democratic Party really blew it in the 2024 election. When you look at the polls that are taken with Latinos, they vote overwhelmingly, they support overwhelmingly a major increase in the minimum wage. Okay, about 85% of Latinos poll. Okay, and remember, many of those polls are going to skew towards even middle class Latinos because they're not polling undocumented people. And yet, what has the Democratic Party done nationally to raise the federal minimum wage? Great majority of Latinos support women's right to choose. Okay, what did the Democratic Party do all those years they had congressional majorities? And the list goes on and on and on. And so I argue in the piece that if anyone's moving to the right, it's the Democratic Party.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yes. I was surprised. I thought more Latinos would actually defect than really did. And I was duped, Lori, by the initial poll. When you look at initial exit polling, that's an important gauge, but it's almost always going to be inaccurate. And there was a one kind of popular poll early that suggested that somehow Latinos, the majority of us, voted for Donald Trump. But that was not true. And that was kind of a snapshot poll taken like the day of and the day after the election. But then as we got, I'll just call them kind of more, I hate to use the term, kind of more balanced polling as time went on, the majorities kind of shifted. But again, the bigger point I'm trying to make, I guess, is that our political parties, I mean, what have the Democrats done to implement, to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza? When the great majority of Latinos said, dude, get this done, man. Get this done.
Yes, yeah. It's just so obvious. Well, Paul Ortiz, before we close, let's talk about the anti-DEI threats and actions that are undermining the very basic teaching of history and how this affects Americans' understanding of the critical role of immigrant workers in our economy and culture. As I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, your book, An African American and Latinx History of the United States, has recently been banned by the Department of Defense. So how do you see a linkage between the attacks on works by and about Latinx history and the federal attacks on immigrant workers?
Lori, chapter one in my book, An African American and Latinx History of the United States, is on the Haitian Revolution. And what this country owes, and I wanted to place the Haitian Revolution, chapter two is the Mexican War of Independence, chapter four is the Cuban War of Liberation in the 19th century. What it has to do is the fact that, and the reason I think that look, if I was in the Department of Defense and I was Pete Hegseth, I would probably ban my book also, because it's dangerous. Because, I mean, think about this. Donald Trump gets up during the presidential debate and totally has this racist attack, makes this racist attack against Haitian people. And millions of people watching that debate, Lori, would probably have thought, oh, well, God, Haitians, wow, that's terrible. They eat pets. It's awful. But even worse, they don't even know who Haitians are. They don't even know Haiti has a history. And what I say in the chapter one of that book is we owe a lot in this country to the Haitian War of Liberation against the French Empire. And in so many ways, freedom fighters in the U.S. gained strength from the Haitian Revolution, especially the anti-slavery movement. And this is what the attacks on DEI are all about and the so-called Stop Woke laws, because the more our students, the more people learn about our connections to Haiti, to Mexico, the Mexican War of Independence, the ways in which enslaved African Americans found sanctuary in Mexico during the slavery era in this country. When you start learning those connections, you get to a point where you mentioned earlier international solidarity. You learn that we have connections in this country to people in Cuba and Mexico and Haiti, and we should be trying to build bridges. That's really the takeaway lesson of my book. I'm just simply kind of recentering U.S. history. I don't really come up with any like new facts in African-American Latinx history. I'm just re-asking us to think of this country as a country in the Americas, as a country in the world. And that's what the Hegseths and the Trumps don't want us to see. They want us to see the U.S. as America first, as isolationist, and especially as white first, okay? They're not always Canada, you know?
And exceptional.
Yeah, exceptional, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I was interested in something you told me earlier about when you speak to public audiences about immigration history, that you're shocked by how the propaganda of the state continues to warp our thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an educator, Laura. You know, you and I are educators. And I guess our bias is that if people only had the facts, if they only learn things, if they could only learn more about the history of immigration and refugees in this country, they would be more sympathetic to immigrants and to refugees. And as an educator, I have to believe that. And I have seen that transform people. I've seen the light bulb go off and people on And people say, oh yeah, immigrants are not my enemy. You know, the bosses are trying to manipulate us against each other. At the same time, you know, we have to remember what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, you know, education without social action is not a very effective tool, and vice versa. So the educator in me says, yeah, I mean, I understand why the state is doing these stop woke laws or trying to destroy African-American studies, even as we speak. They're trying to destroy Latinx studies, especially intersectional works, Lori. That's very interesting. When Ron DeSantis came to power in Florida, the first thing he attacked was the concept of intersectionality. And that's the, and again, I don't blame him, because when you begin to understand the connections between the oppression of women, the oppression of immigrants, the oppression of workers, then you're on the road to recovery, as if you will. You're on the road to understanding how we come together to unite and build solidarity. And intersectionality, I would argue, is, you know, maybe it's even a kind of a watered down corollary of solidarity, you know. But that, those are things the state doesn't, the state, you know, Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth, you know, they don't want you to learn about the Haitian Revolution. They don't want you to learn about the Mexican War of Independence, but they especially don't want you to believe that countries like Mexico or Haiti have anything to offer the US. That's the big thing. Because if you start believing that, oh, if you read Mexico's federal constitution, there's a reason Mexico doesn't go around the country carpet bombing people. You know, they could, Mexico could have a big air force like Israel. It could go around bombing people, but it doesn't do that. Why? Because Mexico developed on certain lines. It has a federal constitution. It takes just about an act of God to get the Mexico to deploy its military outside of its national boundaries. Now, I'm not saying Mexico is a perfect nation, has a lot of challenges, right? But I'm saying that there's so much we could learn from a nation like Mexico. But instead, Donald Trump wants us to be ignorant. That's the big thing. That's what these stop woke laws are about. That's what these anti-DEI laws are about. And as labor organizers, we have to, as educators, educate people. But as labor organizers, we have to realize, I think at a certain point, we're just going to have to out-organize the Trumps and the Hegseths, because they're not interested in having a conversation with us, right?
And it's not a bad idea to kind of look at Mexico now for some instruction in the Moreno Party.
Dr. Paul Ortiz. Pretty good president, right? Yeah.
Paul Ortiz, thanks so much for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll link to some of your work on the KBOO website. Thanks so much.
That was the phenomenal LA-based band Wake doing Jornaleros. And before that, you were listening to the Old Mole's Lori Mercier speaking with labor historian Paul Ortiz. And now on to excerpts from a 2017 interview I did with climate justice and labor activist Tim Norgren. The interview will be available soon on video via the open source Climate Justice Archive, The Thin Green Line is People's History Project.
So, Tim, how'd you get involved in fossil fuel organizing?
Oh, geez. I guess the kind of culminating factor would have been Occupy. I grew up on science. Climate change makes sense. The funny thing, I guess, was just becoming aware of that as an issue. You know, as an activist, I've been picking up things as I came along, but when the science of climate change came up at first, it's little tidbits here and there and not really putting the things together. So what ended up happening is I'm working for the laborers union and actually was working on an LNG pipeline when Occupy Wall Street came up. And so here I was taking my money from, you know, working this fossil fuel job and donating, going and buying food for the Occupy encampments and so forth. And it's really getting involved with that, which is, I saw as an outlet to becoming active for a bigger purpose, seeing that, having known forever that the big money was oppressing the rest of us, I was trying to get involved in that. And it's really there that I saw this rising tide bunch and heard people talking about the climate issues. And soon after that, the smallest Occupy encampment that there was, Occupy the Gorge or Mosier, I started going to meetings with those folks. And, you know, this little kind of affinity group came out of that to work against these coal trains and the oil trains that were coming down the gorge. And, you know, as soon as I tapped into that knowledge, it was really obvious that this is a major issue. I mean, this is something that goes as big as, you know, the extinction of the species, most species anyway, to just simple everyday issues like whether our lives are sustainable. The same things that brought Occupy together that were used in the media to kind of separate people, saying, oh, there's so many different issues. Well, it kind of became apparent that they're all part of the same thing in this basic biological situation of what's going to happen to the climate and what's going to happen to our food supply and so forth. Seems to tie it together. So, you know, I started getting involved and getting over my fear of speaking in public, going to these hearings and going, just feeling my face just turn red and being completely nervous and just speaking anyway and just pushing through that one hearing at a time to getting further involved in more direct action and that kind of thing.
Yeah, do you want to talk more about Occupy? So you met the Rising Tide folks in the Occupy camp.
Became aware of them there. Yeah, the Occupy the Gorge kind of formed something. The Gorge Climate Action Network was a smaller group of more rural people who were doing that. And at the same time, I was becoming aware of the Rising Tide folks and started getting to know them a little bit. I was actually out on a laborer's job when I really met Rising Tide folks. Ironically, another fossil fuel job that I by then was avoiding, but I said, okay, I'll go take this job as a favor to the dispatcher. Really needed to fill this thing out in Port Westward. So I went out there and doing cleanup on this LNG power station. And they'd been talking about how the cops were pulling people over for speeding. And I pulled out and I saw there's the lights going. I thought, oh, they're getting the speeders or whatever. And as I got closer, I came to see there's this several cars and this big presence. And I thought, oh, good, it's a little protest. Somebody's speaking up about it. That's awesome. And I went and asked the cop, like, hey, what's up with this police presence? Why are you making such a big deal of a little protest? And they said, well, they're blocking the tracks. And I thought, awesome. And I went and parked my car and came on down to the protest, took off my work clothes so I wouldn't be recognized, you know, and came down to the protest where they had a tripod on the tracks. And
so they were protesting the project you were working on?
They're protesting a project that's right adjoining the project I was working on. There's an ethanol plant that they're trying to convert to an export facility for the, I guess, the shale oil. And right next to that was this LNG facility that I was working on there. So the same people were involved, basically. So my bosses, of course, were involved in the whole thing, heads of this project. So anyway, I changed clothes and got involved and shuttled people back and forth and joined the protests and got to know some local farmers who were fighting against it. Ended up showering at their houses because I was camping in my van at the time. And a few weeks later, my boss comes up to me and says, so were you happen to be like involved in a protest down there? And I knew this guy well enough to go, well, not officially. And he says, okay, that's what I thought. And nothing came of that. And if it had, so be it. You know, it was just an evolving sense that what was going on was really wrong. I had already been to these hearings and met leaders of my union on the other side of the issue. And when I saw that happening, of course, the question comes up of why are you on that side of it? And what is the issue that ties this union and how is it really affecting it? And so then I started looking into, is this benefiting our union? Are we doing any good by pursuing these projects? And what I came to find out is these projects are the really short-term carrot on a stick that's dangled out there for few leaders who, unfortunately, with the building trades unions, in a lot of cases, are paid off in a bigger way on a national level, to where I did some digging and found out that the leader of our union has been working with the same people, the Koch brothers, the Americans for Prosperity, as they call themselves, and ALEC, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Bribes for Bills Club. They're working with these people that are writing state-by-state legislation to squash unions so that they can push for a fossil fuel project. You know, the Keystone, I think, was the start of a lot of it, and then it's moved on. They're working on Coos Bay here in Oregon now, and there's been all kinds of politics where they've brushed off union candidates to support someone who is more middle of the road, like Hillary Clinton, with no union vote and that kind of thing. So I found that it was really important in my heart to speak out about that and just go, hey, this rank and file movement that became unions is being squashed from within, and we need to do something to reclaim our power as unions. So
So can you say more about the hostility of fossil fuel corporations to labor?
The interesting part is that the hostility is obvious in the actions. I mean, the fossil fuel corporations are part of bigger groups. Like I said, Alec, they're more of like lobbying groups who as a whole promote business interests. And of course, labor is a commodity to those people. We are an expense. And so us having rights, having safety clauses, it affects their bottom line. And they want to, of course, get the most out of us, the commodity that they can, the same as they do out of the living planet as a whole. So we're just being used the same as any other part of the whole world, basically. So it's in our interest to fight against these things. And we have become so used to being manipulated by this propaganda machine. I mean, there's so many myths that pervade everything in our culture, from the idea of original sin. I mean, you can go back that far to the idea that there's something wrong with us. And yet, in order to make ourselves worthy, we're taught that we need to continue to pursue the things that have made us unworthy. You know, the idea that, okay, so we ate this fruit of knowledge, that we have the knowledge of good and evil. We know what is better for the world. And so as a result, we've separated ourselves from the natural world. We've come to a dominant relationship with the rest of living creation or whatever, so that we're taught to dominate and that's going to solve our problem. But we're completely missing out on the fact that if we stopped believing that we had the answers, the idea that we have the answer, the knowledge of good and evil, then we're going to be right back there in the garden. And that's the thing. We are animals. We are the basic living foundation of what is. Here we are trying to separate ourselves from everything else and from each other. And it's being played against us. You know, that the whole thing that was going on with that garden and in that story in the natural world, as it's been for tribal people from the get-go, the thing that's basic in all of that is abundance. I mean, that garden was the picture of abundance. It still is. That natural world is being depleted, and yet there is so much. We have so much. I mean, just living in this little plot of land here at my house in the suburbs of the gorge, there's plenty of room for me to grow a couple extra beds and offer that to the community so that people can just come by and take food, because I have plenty right here in this little space. We can share these resources. And you look at, say, 100 years ago, you've got things like the Bread and Roses Strike. Okay, it's a bunch of textile workers in Massachusetts were striking to improve the conditions of their labor, and yet these big bosses came in and were using the military facilities of the time, the police force, to do the will of the rich. And they oppressed people. The women had to take their children and go to places where they could eat, where there were supporters out of state. And so the cops came in and they beat people up in the train stations on their way out of town. And the workers actually stood up and persevered. And a lot of what inspired that is just a shared understanding that we are being degraded as human beings. We're being degraded as living creatures, period. And they were able to see that clearly. The myths were not so clear. We didn't have the same propaganda machine that's telling us that there is scarcity and that's just the way it is, and so we need to fight amongst each other. They got together and said, no, you have money, you have power, and we should not be living this way. And so that degradation led them to reclaim what is ours to begin with. So here we are struggling against armed military forces and coming out ahead, forming the unions, getting these rights that we have now. I mean, the 8-hour day, the vacation pay, all this stuff that we take for granted right now, that makes it so easy for us union members to go, oh, well, we need that fossil fuel terminal. We need this to just get the food on the table because things are so scarce, and we just need to hold on to what we have. Well, those things weren't there 100 years ago.
It keeps on raining, the levee's gonna break. It keeps on raining, the levee's gonna break. The levee breaks, I had no place to stay.
That was a bit of the haunting Playing for Change version of the song When the Levee Breaks, written and first recorded by Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe McCoy in 1929 about the 1927 Great Mississippi Flood. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Desiree Helgers, and I'm your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. And we return now to a 2017 interview with climate justice labor activist Tim Norgren, taped during the first Trump administration.
You know, when I started having a conversation about the middle class disappearing or something, then even the most right-wing people are going, well, yeah, that needs to change. And just being able to bring out where we've been divided and conquered is a big part of organizing with any group of people. The unions have come together in the first place and stood up to organize for all working people. We're all part of this, and now it's time for the people who are losing the majority of what's there to stand up and take that garden back, take those resources back. And so as that's happened, it's evolved where we realized our degradation, you know, 100 years ago. Now we've got lots of little things that maybe make life easier. You know, we've got television, we've got amusement parks to take our kids to, we've got shopping malls where, you know, you go and make that money at that job that is dangled in front of you, because, you know, if you go work for the pipeline, you're going to get a little more money and your family's going to get to go to the shopping mall and have whatever they want, you know. Or if you're not in one of the have groups, maybe you are the poor person, the minority, and maybe you're just that kid who grows up in a wealthy household, as I was, knowing that stuff's wrong and wanting to rebel. Then you go for the other distractions, you know, the drugs and alcohol are always there and available. I know that heroin's pumped up in Flint, Michigan now, and in all these places where people don't even have clean water, they're being poisoned. And so all of a sudden the heroin supply goes up. And here I am, a part of a fighting union, you know, the people that were originally fighting for what's ours, taking it back, are supporting the same kind of aggressive tactics, the same kind of violence against people standing up for their rights, like, for example, Standing Rock, you know, using military weapons to keep people down, the same kind of tactics where we were shot down on picket lines being used in places like that. And yet, because that carrot on a stick is so vivid in our imagination, that distraction, that idea of that, all the movies and the video games we've seen and all the ideas we have from what we've been fed our whole life, that fruit that we've yet to spit out is just choking us to where we think that's important. We've got to keep ours. And so now we've got to fight those people to keep what's ours. And those loafers on unemployment, well, even though we're maybe a seasonal worker who gets unemployment part of the year, we're still going to fight those loafers who are just sucking the system. All those welfare people, they're different, right? We're taught that anyone who is not directly in our clique is someone to be fought, and we're just missing the whole point. Those tactics are used against us. We are the working people, we are the minorities, we are the oppressed. Even though the reality is that scarcity that we're seeing is an illusion. We don't have any scarcity. It's just the fact that all of these things are being pocketed by a few people with the power of illusion, the power of the media, the power of shopping malls and drugs and porn and all the things that keep us feeling like, oh, we've got just enough that it's not worth getting out and being shot at. I don't want to have to do that. I want my kids to be safe. I don't want to have to go out and have them losing their daddy because he doesn't come home from a union demonstration or something, you know? So I'm not going to fight that thing, the thing that separates us from any oppressed people in any given time has always been the degree to which we're willing to actually do something about it. And it doesn't take that much.
Are there things that you remember as real high points in the struggle for you?
Well, I've seen the power of group action, because while there's a lot of this fear going on, there is a movement that's growing, obviously. So groups of people have gotten together at, say, the line of Anacortes, and just simply by being there, shut down all the barges for the time that we were there to blockade them at two major oil terminals. I picked out a day when President Obama was in town for my own more single person action, which of course is never one person, because there's always a support team and it wouldn't happen without people working together. But when a few people get together, you're able to do something like call the president out on his hypocrisy when he's talking about how solid he is about climate change, and then he's embracing a trade deal that is going to end up with shipping goods across the world four times, at the same time among a billion other things that are going to support fossil fuel companies and the like. Then you can maybe get some attention by blockading the tracks.
So you're protesting the TPP?
Yeah, I was protesting the Trans-Pacific Partnership there, and calling Obama's bluff on it as loudly as I could, just by being there. Just I was present for 25 hours on the tracks, and I got a message out to the press, and that got to take up some airtime while Obama was busy promoting this TPP and trying to make everybody think that this was good and probably succeeding with a lot of people.
So what did you do exactly?
I lucked down to a barrel full of cement and other items, and we stuck it on the tracks, and I cuffed myself to it just so that no trains could come through this line from the oil terminal to the main line. And at the same time, we notified media, let people know I wore an adult diaper because I knew I may be locked down for a while. And just by being there, by putting myself in the way of business as usual, was able to get that message across. And I was told one of the people who was helping me in that action was so inspired by that, that he ended up, when there was a blockade at the Fenneca at the Shall Know protest, this person was inspired enough to go out on the railroad tracks at a different bridge down the line and lock himself to the drawbridge, chain his neck with the bike lock to the drawbridge so that that couldn't open. And he delayed that thing for an hour and a half by himself, just by inspiration. And so it's just one little seed of fire, as it were, leads
That's
to
Jonah,
another.
The juror you're talking about?
Yeah, Jonah was out there. He had to wait for the time to be right. And when police were so thick, he still staked it out. And then when they got distracted by what we were doing on the other line, I was out in the kayak myself on that one. Climbers were hanging and we were doing everything we could on that end. All of a sudden the police diminished in the area where he was going for, and he was able to run in and lock himself down. You know, and then no doubt that inspired other actions. And so this progresses. And I think that's what we need to do, is empower each other. I mean, we have to remember that we have the power to do these things. If we see someone close to us or someone that we know, just an everyday human being, realizing that these are just people I work with, people that I know from whatever in town are doing these things, that, hey, maybe I can do that too.
Can you talk about the kayak experience? Because you had not kayaked prior to the Fenneca action.
So with the action that I'm talking about with the Fenneca, this big icebreaker that was, had come back from the first ever offshore Arctic ice cap drilling, thanks to climate change, they could get in there. Well, they needed an icebreaker to do this, another Obama allowed it kind of thing. And so this icebreaker was there at the dock. It came up that people were going to go out and use kayaks to get in the water and do something about this. And I was inspired. It was just a, hey, let's break our usual box as activists. Let's get out and take another medium, as it were. Just another, you know, an artist might use paints or chalks. You know, here's another medium for us to, we don't need the railroad tracks now. We can get out on the water. And so it was my first time in a kayak. I had this kayak that I patched a couple days before the action that I set out on. And I went out and joined a lot of folks, and we raised banners in front of the Fenneca to get public attention to what was going on there, and got some press out there and got people aware, and probably got a lot of the activists that ended up in that blockade a week later involved. I went out later with some folks from the Backbone campaign, and we took some stage lights and spotlighted the boat and put some gobos in, which basically puts a message out with the spotlight, and we're able to get some media attention out that way, and learn how to kayak right there. Just went out, and it wasn't that bad. It was an adventure. It was fun. It's the kind of thing you do when you're a kid and you get out on water skis or a kayak or whatever. You're just out doing something for the first time, and it's not scary. It's fun. It's like, oh, cool, I get to learn this new thing. And so I was having a blast getting out there, learning how to raise banners at the same time and do this kind of thing. And I went to work. I had a job that ended up lasting 3 days. I was out of cell service and then came back to this blast of text messages going, okay, there's climbers hanging from the bridge and all this stuff's happening, and get out here. And I showed up and people had been there for 3 days, basically holding the line, where there were a lot of people who were just exhausted, needed to sleep. They'd been up for that whole time or most of it. And so I volunteered to take a night shift and just watch the gear. And it just so happened that that was when people behind the Fenneca decided to make a run for it. And so just as dawn had broken and all these people were home resting, all of a sudden word gets out, hey, get in the water, this boat's coming. And so there was probably 15 of us there who could get into kayaks, and we just went for the ones that were there and jumped in them. And so there was a very small number of boats out on the river, and here's this giant icebreaker coming. And it was really kind of a Goliath-looking thing, I guess. And here we are facing off against this giant, and it's coming down the river at us. And we're hearing, okay, well, the mayor has sent the police out to block the park, so people are not coming to reinforce you. You are going to have to stay on this line. And it was so exhilarating. It was just like scary and thrilling at the same time. Like that whole, it's not scary, just jumped off a notch to the, okay, this is the adrenaline ride of doing something really awesome that, again, you feel at certain times in your life. You're just having an adventure. And then to watch that boat kind of turn on jets around and go back and like, ha, we kicked your ass, you know, you go back. It was pretty amazing. I mean, yeah, it did come back. They regrouped and tried again. And by then we had all kinds of people out on the river, and we had just this kind of circus of resistance. We had people on the shore, just having those kayaks out there, having those climbers, having these different mediums coming at it from different angles seems to be a really empowering thing for everyone involved. And I think it's also important to let those who would oppress and destroy us know that you're not safe just because you have an airplane or you have whatever you have. We're going to find ways to get to you. We're going to find ways to stop your business. And that's exactly what we need to keep doing.
Were you afraid out on the water?
I mean, a little bit.
You know, can you talk more about that? Because I think, you know, people might feel like, oh, you know, that looked like fun or whatever, but there was a lot of people who are really inexperienced. And
yeah, I was one of them. I wasn't able to move fast. You know, there were people who ended up showing up, especially in the afternoon, who were really experienced. You could go right up to the Coast Guard ship and say, hey, why are you such a bully? And they'd reach for him with these hooks and try and hook their boats, which had the duct tape over the straps anyway. And they'd back paddle and just spray water at them and dodge around. And going, yeah, I'm nowhere that good, and yet was completely inspired. But yeah, seeing that huge boat coming at you, yeah, that was scary. It was a physical threat to my existence at the time, and yet realizing that we're all facing a huge threat to our physical existence has helped me in a huge way. I mean, at some point, when you really get down to survival as a species, as an individual, our species is looking at something that will escalate. Climate change is something that is going very slowly, and then it reaches a feedback loop, and it's like going over a waterfall. And so at some point I had to deal with the fact that, you know, we're looking at death no matter what. And really, if you look within yourself as a human being, you're looking at death, whether that comes from a major catastrophic species-wide extinction or it comes just in a few more years when you die as a human being, period. Whether it be in a car wreck or old age, you're going to die. So I think it prompted me to look at that a little sooner. And I think when you make your peace with that, however it comes, with the fact of your own mortality, it's also empowering. And I don't know how much I thought about that at the time, but I think what took over was my deeper understanding of what we're up against and how important it is, and my inspiration by seeing other people who are just amped and ready to take it. And there's an inner smile that comes from going, you know what, I am alive and I am mortal and I'm gonna die sometime, and I am a living animal being who's got every much the right to do something about this as anyone else.
You've been listening to a 2017 interview with climate justice and labor activist Tim Norgren. The video of that interview will soon be available via the open source Climate Justice Archive. The Thin Green Line is People's History Project. The archive is a rich resource for journalists, researchers, environmental lawyers, teachers, and the general public. Many thanks to Fran Michel, who edited excerpts from the interview. And that wraps up today's Omul Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. This is Desiree Helligers, and I've been your host for today's show. Thanks are due also to Lori Mercier and her guest, Paul Ortiz, speaking on his book, An African American and Latinx History of the U.S. I'm going to play out today's show with the brilliant Playing for Change version of the 1929 song, When the Levee Breaks, which is about the 1927 Great Mississippi Flood, and it was written and first recorded by Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe McCoy.
Yeah. listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.